You're listening to The Central Cast, recorded each week in front of a live audience in Glendale, California.
Parallels and Paradoxes, where we are looking at how some different world religions run parallel to certain aspects in Christianity. So far in this series, we've looked at Hinduism and Buddhism. Today, we're looking at Islam. But the goal of this series is to not just come to understand these other world religions in a deeper level, but through comparing them and understanding maybe how they relate or parallel certain aspects of Christianity, come to understand Christianity on a deeper level. And really, in my vision, my hope is that this series is going to elucidate or help us come to understand the human condition better. Because ultimately, I think to really understand humanity, really understand ourselves universally on a spiritual level, I think we must be students of the sacred. There is something about our faiths, our traditions, our religions that really represent the depth dimension of who we are as people, as a species, actually. And so that's my hope of this series. The goal isn't to, you know, do a comparative religious study so that we can learn to affirm these other religions we currently feel animosity towards, because I don't believe this community feels animosity towards any of these religions. The goal is rather to understand them and ourselves on a deeper level. And so today we're looking at Islam. The word Islam actually means submission or obedience. Sacrifice. Muslim means one who submits, one who sacrifices, or one who obeys. Interestingly, Islam began in the 7th century AD, or in the Common Era, 7th century Arabia in the city of Mecca, which is where Muhammad was born and raised, and where he received a series of visions in some caves nearby, as the story goes, from the angel Gabriel, who dictated to him the Quran. And then Muhammad, as the story goes, later retold that dictation verbatim to some scribes who wrote it down. And what's interesting about the Quran is that it really is a lot like the Old Testament, or a lot like the Bible. It includes a lot of the same stories we find in the Pentateuch, or the Torah. Stories of Adam and Eve, Abraham, Moses, even Jesus is mentioned. What's interesting about the Quran, though, is it's actually in other ways significantly different than the Bible. The Bible is full of, you know, it's written by many different authors spanning centuries, lots of different genres in there. We've got historical biography and gospel and letters, and there's poetry, there's songs, there's saga, there's lots of different genres of writing, lots of different authors in the Bible. The Quran is written really just by one person. And it's really just sort of a prophecy, an explanation of a variety of different theological, historical, and even legislative ideas. Time will not permit us to go into the long and fascinating history of Islam and how it spread. And what's interesting, though, is that after just 100 years of its existence, in the 8th century, after only existing for about 100 years, it really took over a lot of the Mediterranean world, essentially from southern Spain, the Straits of Gibraltar area, north Morocco and southern Spain, all the way to India in just 100 years. And what's interesting, Islam really promoted itself, and still does, as the kind of last iteration of these what's called Abrahamic monotheistic faiths, meaning Judaism and Christianity. Islam sees itself as perhaps the latest iteration and perhaps the purest iteration of this Abrahamic monotheism. Monotheism meaning the worship of one God. Islam traces its roots all the way back to Abraham, just like Judaism does and just like Christianity does. And what's interesting is that Islam really took shape as a reaction in some ways against the polytheism of early medieval Arabia. The Arabia of the pre-Islamic Arabia, we're talking like the 5th or 6th century, was really a hodgepodge of different deities being worshipped and venerated. Lots of different gods and goddesses and deities. The veneration of disembodied spirits was also very popular, so people were worshipping their ancestors. And Islam took shape in that environment as a reaction against all that polytheism, and perhaps even as an attempt to stamp it out. And of course, the only monotheistic faiths that were existent at that time in the 7th century of Arabia were Judaism and Christianity. And so it makes sense that Islam would be a takeoff on that and incorporate a lot of those ideas. And in fact, Muhammad really saw himself, and the Quran really portrays him as a prophet in the lineage of Abraham and Moses and Jesus, and on that same tier. Isn't that interesting? So one could see Islam as really an Arabic version of Christianity and Judaism. Now that's an oversimplification of it, right? But it's an attempt to help us frame it. In the same way that Christianity can really be understood as a Hellenized Judaism, Christianity can be understood as Judaism through a Greek filter, so Islam can be understood really as an Arabic take on Judaism and Christianity. Again, an oversimplification, but perhaps one that's helpful in framing it here this morning. Now, any study of Islam must include a look at what's called the five pillars of Islam. These are the five core tenets of this faith that is shared pretty much by all of its adherents, regardless if you're Sunni or Shia, and we'll get to Sunni and Shia descriptions in a minute. But here are the five pillars of Islam, the core tenets. One, that there is only one God. There's that monotheism, right? And Muhammad is his prophet. Two, a faithful Muslim prays five times a day while facing Mecca. Three, charitable giving is required, especially to help the poor. Four, ritual fasting is required, especially in the month of Ramadan. And five, you must make a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in your life, if you are physically and I think financially able to do so, is the other caveat. Now, depending on your particular version of Islam, the particular sect or school of thought you adhere to, these pillars can be looked at and interpreted in different ways. But again, these pillars are really ubiquitous throughout, or universal throughout Islam. And Islam can be broken down essentially into two different sects, two different denominations, you could say. Those are Sunnis and Shias. Sunnis comprise approximately 85% of the global population. They are, you know, the most, 85% approximately. Shias come in at about 15%. Both branches include worshipers who run the gamut from secular to conservative, or fundamentalist to progressive, you could say. And the real difference between these two sects, Sunni and Shia, is traced back all the way to Muhammad. This came down to originally who was going to succeed Muhammad as the leader of Islam. Some believe that there should be, upon Muhammad's death, there should be an election, a democratic election, where a new leader, a new imam would be elected. These became Sunnis. Okay. Others believe that Muhammad's next of kin should, you know, be in charge after him. Just follow a bloodline for the rest of history. These became Shias. Now that's a very simple definition of the difference between Sunni and Shia. There are significant other differences that developed over the centuries between their understandings of the faith, but that's how it began. In general, Sunnis tend to emphasize God's power in the world, specifically God's power in the material world, God's power in the public realm, in the realm of politics. Sunnis tend to focus more on that. Shias tend to focus more on the otherworldly and eschatological aspects of Islam. Eschatological is a fancy seminary word, meaning having to do with the age to come, having to do with heaven, having to do with this new world order, okay? And for this reason, Shias are often called 12ers, meaning the number 12, 12ers, meaning that they really are focused on looking forward to and believing in this idea of a 12th imam coming into the world as a messianic figure, coming into the world and setting up, you know, a kind of global caliphate, a global kingdom of Allah. And they actually believe that Christ will return with this 12th imam to do this. Isn't that interesting? They believe that Christ will be with this 12th imam, instituting this new world order. This is an interesting combination of both Christian and Islamic eschatology here. This idea of the second coming is, of course, a big part of, you know, classic traditional Christianity, right? But here we find it specifically in Islam and specifically in Shiite Islam, this belief in this 12th imam. A minority of Sunnis share this messianic view, but some certainly do. There is a third sect within Islam, and this is the one I really want to focus on today. And it's not so much a sect as it is a school of thought or a movement that permeates both Sunni and Shiite sects. It is called Sufism, and Sufism is really the mystical side of Islam. It is Islamic mysticism, Sufism. And I want to focus on this most today. Sufism has existed since the time of Muhammad. It's been a part of Islam since the beginning. It emphasizes, as many mystical traditions and other faiths do, a deeper connection with God. In this case, a deeper connection with Allah. This deeper connection is acquired through various spiritual practices, not just going, you know, and abiding by the five pillars, but through other practices, asceticism, meaning taking a vow of poverty, these kinds of things. Perhaps the most famous Sufis are the whirling dervishes. Anybody hear of the whirling dervishes before? Yeah, the whirling dervishes of Turkey. And I have a picture of them here this morning. Fascinating group. There they are. These are Sufi Sunnis. All right, so they're Sufis. Again, Sufi simply means mystic. They are Sunni mystics who are part of a special order called the Mevlevi order. We call them dervishes. The word dervish is actually Persian. It's not Islamic. Dervish simply is the Persian word for mystic, or the Persian word for Sufi. But that's what they are. They are Sunni Sufis of the Mevlevi order. So it really gets broken down. They're not just Sufis, but they're of the Mevlevi order. But anyway, we call them whirling dervishes. Fascinating group. And the idea behind their whirling is actually really, really powerful, really interesting. You'll notice that their right hand is held up like this, the palm facing up, and then the left hand is facing down. This is to communicate this connection between heaven and earth. One hand pointed on high, the other hand pointed to earth. And as they spin, they look at the left hand. And they spin from right to left, meaning in the direction of their heart. And what's being communicated here is this desire to love all of humanity. This dance is an attempt to communicate these themes of the as above, so below, this connection between the divine and the human, this connection between the transcendent and the immanent, God's presence here among us. And then, of course, this turning towards the heart is meant to communicate their desire to be inclusive of all people, not just Muslims. This kind of mysticism is radically inclusive of people of other faiths, other walks of life. But this dance, it's a kind of meditation, a kind of prayer. The goal in the spinning, and if you ever spin as much as even a fraction of what they do, you know how dizzy you get, right? The goal of the spinning is to enter into an altered state of consciousness. The goal of the spinning is to enter into a kind of trance-like state so that one's ego and sense of self is shed and that one experiences this deeper connection with the presence of God. But in this kind of dance, in this meditation, is this prayer that God's kingdom, you could say, might come to earth, that there might be this merging of the heavenly and the earthly. And then, of course, the spinning towards the left, towards their heart, is meant to be a meditation on the love of all mankind, the radical inclusivity of all of mankind into their mysticism. Isn't that interesting? Broadly speaking, Sufi thought is really quite interesting, and I think it's the aspect of Islam that we can relate to most here at Central. You know, we are essentially a church or a community of Christian mystics. Quite often we define ourselves as Christians. We don't say Christian Sufis, but we can say that here this morning. We are essentially Christian mystics, Christian Sufis here. And we trace a lot of our roots here, and a lot of the, you could say, a lot of what I say up here can be traced back to the mystics, the medieval church mystics of the church, the Middle Ages. But what's so interesting about Muslim mysticism is its focus on two things that we also focus on: religious pluralism and the utter unknowability of God. Those two things, religious pluralism, radical inclusivity, and the utter unknowability of God. Numerous passages in the Quran teach that Muslims are to be tolerant and even affirming, not just tolerant, but affirming of other faiths. And I want us to look at a few of these passages from the Quran this morning. Here they are up on the screen. The prophet believes in what has been revealed to him by his cherisher, Allah, as do the faithful. Each one believes in God and their angels, their books, and their prophets. We make no distinction between them. Among their God's works, meaning the gods of other nations, is the creation of the heavens and the earth, like what we find in Genesis 1, and the variety of your tongues and complexions, meaning skin tone, race, ethnicity, right? Surely these are signs for those who understand. Then finally, had God willed, God would have made you a single community, but instead God calls whomever God wills with divine compassion. It's the Quran. Isn't that wonderful? We find numerous appeals to diversity and pluralism here, and honoring the traditions, the beliefs, and the heritage of many different people. In fact, such statements in the Quran make religious tolerance, especially, it makes religious intolerance, especially against Jews and Christians who are spiritual siblings of Muslims. It makes religious intolerance against them an act of unbelief. Makes it an act of unbelief, an act of true heresy, an act of defying the teachings of Allah. And yet, unfortunately, this has not stopped many Muslims, just as it hasn't stopped many Christians throughout history from practicing violence, religiously motivated violence against people of other faiths, even forcing conversions. There have been and always will be adherents in both faiths, Christianity and Islam, and others. There has been and always will be adherents that ignore the central tenets of their own scriptures, especially those tenets that teach love and tolerance. But it's often the mystics that function as a corrective to these more fundamentalist elements within their faiths. Mystics are really good at this, no matter what faith we're talking about, Islam, Christianity, because mysticism often requires an open-mindedness and an embrace of mystery and the unknowing that fundamentalists often lack. Mystics tend to emphasize the universal presence of God, the universal presence of the divine in all things and in all people. Mystics often emphasize this merging of flesh and spirit, heaven and earth, as above, so below. This is a hallmark of mysticism. And this in turn has social consequences, yes? Because once one affirms the presence of the divine everywhere and in everybody, inclusivity, plurality, and focusing on matters of social justice become paramount, become central to your faith, right? But Sufism is also focused on the utter unknowability of God. The most succinct statement about God that can be found in the Quran might be this, and this will be up on the screen. They, God, they are one. They, God, eternal, impenetrable, neither birthing nor birth. There is nothing comparable to the one. To say that nothing is comparable to the one and that the one is impenetrable is to say that nothing can be ultimately or factually said about God. Even claims about God's oneness and eternal nature are immediately destabilized by this idea that God is impenetrable and incomparable to anything in existence, anything that we know. This is not unlike the Hebrew practice today of never speaking the name of God. Are you aware of that? That even among Orthodox Jewish circles today, they refuse to even utter the name of God. Instead, they refer to God as simply Hashem. You've heard me talk about this before, maybe. Hashem simply is translated the name. It's just a placeholder term. And Orthodox Jews historically have refused to utter the more holy names of God like Yahweh, Elohim, Adonai, not just because they want to preserve God's holiness, but because they want to preserve God's complete otherness, the unknowability of God, the fact that God cannot be domesticated. That's why they say Hashem. They want to be reminded of God's unknowability constantly. God does not fit any descriptions or concepts that we have. We find the same idea in Islam. In fact, the Arabic term for God is Allah, but Allah is it doesn't just mean God or Lord. In fact, nobody really knows what it means. In fact, this morning in one of the texts you saw me talk about, or you saw it mentioned God as cherisher, Allah as cherisher. Allah can be translated as cherisher, nourisher, sustainer. Allah can be translated simply as reality and life. Nobody really knows. Arabic is an extremely mysterious and poetic language. Nobody really knows what Allah means. Isn't that interesting? This is not unlike the apophatic tradition within Christianity, within Christian mysticism, especially from the Middle Ages. Apophatic simply means to deny or to negate. And so you had Christian mystics in the Middle Ages saying, in other words, as a way of describing God, they would describe what God is not. They would say, God is not good. Because to say that God is good is to say that, you know, good could always be better. They would say God is not a being. Because God transcends our feeble human definitions of beinghood and existence. Some Christian mystics in the Middle Ages actually would even say God does not exist. Because to say that God exists is to say something about existence that we don't have access to. God transcends our ability to define existence. God is not an object. He is not a being like us. Now, this sounds a lot like atheism. And that's because I think it's meant to blur. It's meant to blur the lines between atheism and theism. It's an attempt to express the ineffable nature of God. Apophatic theology is an attempt to express the ineffable nature of God. It's a way of saying that God is so far beyond our feeble human definitions and understanding of things that it's best not to make any claims about him, her, it at all. As soon as we describe God, we domesticate her in some ways. We lower God to our level when God cannot be lowered to our level, to the realm of human understanding. Now, of course, this raised questions in the Middle Ages just like it does now. Like, well, then what's the point of being a Christian? What's the point of affirming God in any way? What's the point of being a part of a religion if God cannot be spoken of? To this, church leaders would respond then as well as now. Although God is unknowable, Jesus as a person can be known. The scriptures themselves can be followed. Therefore, following Christ and following the scriptures is the human way of seeing God. And the same response would be given in Islam. To people would say, well, what's the point of participating in the religious structure of Islam if God is completely other than and unknowable? Muslims, clerics, and mystics would say, well, Muhammad was a person, and the Quran is a book that can be followed. Following Muhammad, following the Quran, is the human way of, putting it in scare quotes, seeing God. Now, apophatic theology has its place, but it also has its limits. I think in order for us to speak of God at all, we must anthropomorphize her in some way. We must speak of God in human terms. We must personify God. We don't have a choice, really. It's impossible not to do so. And that's okay, just as long as we always have one foot in apophatic theology, so that we never think that we've got God figured out. Our conception of God must always be tentative. Our conception of God must always be exposed to the abyss of unknowing. Our conception of God must always be radically open to a kind of humility, a kind of open-mindedness. Otherwise, it calcifies into a kind of fundamentalism or dogmaticism. This means that true belief is not grounded in certainty, but uncertainty. True belief must always be exposed to the utter unknowability of God. True believers know what I mean. True believers experience doubt and unbelief all the time. This understanding of belief is really at the heart of all three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, this utter unknowability of God. And this means that paradox, the title of this series is Parallels and Paradoxes. We're not just talking about how other religions might parallel certain aspects of Christianity, but how they might reveal a paradox. This way of thinking about God is deeply paradoxical. Paradox lies at the heart of all of these religions we're studying, but specifically today in these Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. These faiths simultaneously make claims about God, his nature and will, and yet destabilize those very same claims by saying that God is unknowable, or to put it in the words of the Quran, impenetrable, incomparable with anything that we are familiar with. But to be clear, the paradoxical nature of these religions does not diminish them in any way. Does not diminish them. In fact, rather the opposite. It is the paradoxical nature of these religions that I think is what makes them as meaningful as they are. Think of it this way. When paradoxes are discovered in mathematics and physics, like when physicists, you ever watch those shows on the Nature Channel or Discovery about, you know, the old Carl Sagan, what is it called? Cosmos. Yeah, Cosmos, thank you. If you ever watched the ones about black holes, I mean, paradox is a big part of modern physics and mathematics, right? And yet, when mathematicians and physics begin talking about black holes and the singularities that sit at the heart of them and how the laws of physics just break down and it's not really feasible how these things can exist in space-time, this is not a cause for sorrow or crisis. No, rather the opposite. It's a cause to feel overwhelmed by the beauty and the grandeur of nature, right? It's an opportunity to feel like two things simultaneously, that we are just this small, tiny part of the universe, and yet we can grasp the infinite with our mind, and how wonderful is that? That's what paradox does for us. It reminds us that we are just a small part of this greater system called the cosmos and life and being, and yet, despite our finitude, despite our tininess, we can grasp a small part of the infinite, the transcendent, with our mind. How wonderful is that? And we come most into contact with the infinite, with the transcendent, with the divine, if you want to put it that way, I think when we encounter paradox, not just in like physics, but in spirituality as well. This way of making claims about God while knowing that they are totally conditioned, that ultimately God is unknowable. This is not a cause for concern or worry. It doesn't diminish our faith in any way. It is the depth dimension of our faith. This should move us, I think, into a place of awe and wonder regarding God, spirituality. It's analogous, in my mind, to Moses catching just a glimpse of God's backside on Mount Sinai. Remember that story? God hid Moses in the cleft of the rock and then passed by him. But Moses just got to see a little bit of God's ass, as it says. Right? Seeing the paradoxical within our faiths is like catching a glimpse of God's arse. But it's a glimpse of the depth dimension of life and being, the depth dimension of our faiths, to hold things into tension like that. And as Christians, we have, I think, a wonderful tradition that I think embodies the paradoxical notion of our faith. Here we find God. That the transcendent supreme being on high became flesh and died. Here is his body and blood, and we consume it. As symbolically, of course, but as a demonstration or as a declaration that the God who dies in the world lives again in us. This is the paradox of Christianity. To partake in the Lord's Supper is to say, in one sentence, God is dead, long live God. This is the paradox that we are invited into. And it is meant to be, I think, illustrative of the human condition. Do we not live in paradox? Is our life not full of paradoxical truths? This is that, the depth dimension of that. We find God, we find eternity, we find the transcendent right here, right now. God is, and yet God is not. God is dead, long live God. That's the meaning of this. I'm not going to explain it more than that because it's a paradox, but I invite you to meditate on that today as we receive the Lord's Supper. Let's pray. Loving God, whose name we do not know, mystery of life and being, the cause of our deepest wonders and hopes and fears, deepen our understanding of what it means to be here, what it means to be now, what it means to be human, what it means to live, to love, and to die.
Each episode of the Central Cast is followed by an interactive discussion. If you'd like to participate in recordings, or if you're interested in exploring progressive faith and theology for a postmodern context, check out centralavenuechurch.org. Here's this week's unedited discussion.
This isn't much, but I just, the twirling dervishes?
Whirling dervishes.
It just made me think of children and how much they like to spin around and spin in circles, and it's kind of a nice thought that maybe when they're doing that, and that fun spinning, it's also connecting the heaven and the earth, and I don't know, it was just kind of a nice thought that I thought I'd share.
It's that childlike wonder, right? In that kind of mysticism. Yeah, I think that's absolutely key, right? Maybe it's a little bit what Jesus meant when he said, in order to come unto me, you have to, you know, come unto me as a child, the kingdom of God, yeah? Somebody else has something they want to say or question. Yeah, Tom.
I just want to point out to you that one of the connections between Islam and Christianity is that the philosophical skeleton of Christianity is Islamic. It's from the Islamic philosophers and their sort of rediscovery of Aristotelian philosophy in the Middle Ages, and then Thomas Aquinas, you know, looks over their shoulders and writes the Summa Theologica. So even the purity of their monotheism, they don't really have sort of the Trinitarian questions that dominated early Christianity. It allowed them to really focus on the idea that you get in Paul and Mars Hill, that in God we live and move and have our being, and the idea of God is the ground of our being, and the philosophical ideas that developed in Christianity owe a lot to a lot of the philosophical work that Muslim philosophers did.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. And let me ask you this, can some of you describe how your faith has maybe become a little bit more mystical over the years? How do you understand mysticism maybe in your own Christianity? And the way that we talked about it today, do you see any of that in your life? Anybody want to share about how their faith has gotten a little more mystical? Yeah, Frank, right? Yeah, welcome.
It's not so much a comment on the question that you just raised, but when you were talking about the paradox of nature, yeah, how it kind of make you feel so small, but at the same time you can understand it. Yeah. I just thought that was really great, and I'd add that it makes you feel really small, but at the same time also very big, like you're part of it, you know. Yeah. So there's a lot of like it's flowing through you. There's like a lot of energy there. So that was interesting. I don't know if that. It doesn't really, not so much for the mystical part, but it was something you said that was nice. I liked it.
Yeah, thanks. I wasn't so sure that was clear, so I'm glad you got that. Talking about singularities and black holes and paradoxes, and it's like the fact that we can even understand that at some level just brings us into contact with that awe and that wonder, which I think is the depth dimension of our faith experience. But yeah, somebody want to share how their faith has maybe gotten a little more mystical over the years and what that looks like for you? Yeah, Rodney.
I'll see if I can put this into words. I think the way for me it's become more mystical is the older I get, the more comfortable I am in affirming my doubts and being comfortable in not knowing. Because I feel like as a kid, the way you're taught as, you know, from your parents, this is the way things are, this is who God is, this is who Jesus is. And the older I get, the more I'm like, I don't know if I really know who God is and can put it into words, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that radical embrace of mystery and knowing is a big part of a lot of mystical traditions, not just Christianity, but it's really a big part of that radical humility. It's really kind of humility. It's a big part of it. Yeah, somebody else. Yeah, Laura.
A
it's short, so you can stay there. going off Rodney, I think with like my daughter having an almost 4-year-old, I'm more comfortable saying I don't know when she asks questions, or saying, what do you think? Is there a heaven? Or like when my father died, she's like, is Papa in heaven? I was like, well, we think, what do you think? And I think that would have made me a lot more nervous to say that 5 years ago or more. And now I kind of embrace that and have more of a conversation with her and help her kind of come through. So children, seeing like the whirling dervishes, like the mysticism in children, that's I think innate. And then helping her and I work through at the same time.
Yeah. So. You have that comfortability with it now, right? Yeah, I'm glad you feel that way. That's important. That's like that's a big deal for us parents. Yeah, somebody else. Yeah, Nisha. I'm gonna pass the mic this way.
When I was a kid, I think I associated the word mystical with magical, and I thought that was, I grew up Hindu, and then I went to a Catholic school growing up, and I thought it was, as a child, really magical that I was allowed to learn other religions, and it was really magical to me to see those similarities. Then I grew up thinking, oh, magical is a very childhood term. But then when I got older, now I'm starting to reintegrate that into my life where it is really magical, like hearing these kind of lectures. And it's a magical transformation to start connecting all the dots in a way. It's kind of childlike again, yeah.
Yeah, and you grew up Hindu, but also Catholic.
I grew up Hindu. I asked to go to a Catholic school. My parents were they went to Christian missionary schools growing up. Then I studied Buddhism in school. That was my degree was Buddhism. So I feel like as I'm growing older, I'm like connecting all these different dots from various religions, but it's a very magical experience, especially being in a very open-minded church like this now. It's kind of, it's interesting. My brain is on fire.
Wait, what did you just say? I didn't catch the end.
Your brain is on fire.
That's pyrotheology, right, guys? Yeah, I'm looking at my pyrotheology friends, yeah. That was really good. I like how you reclaim the word magic, because I think in some ways with our deconstruction here, because so many of us are what you call recovering fundamentalists, right? Coming out, we're post-evangelical, a lot of us, and some of us are even kind of post-theistic, right? Meaning we don't believe in that supreme being anymore, perhaps. But I think there is that, I love that idea of reclaiming the magic. Because I think that's what we're doing here in a way. And through that awe and wonder for just life and being, the awe and wonder that can be just simply, you know, the appreciation of what it means to live in love. That can be a kind of endless, you know, repository of magic, really. I find it to be a place of deep transcendence, deep magic. The best kind of magic. The realest kind of magic. We'll put it like that. Yeah. Somebody else want to reflect? Yeah, Kimberly.
As I have opened myself up to the possibility over this past several months of maybe there isn't a personality to offend, that's been the big question in my mind and in my heart, because I've struggled with perfectionism my whole life. Very sensitive conscience, big, big guilt complex. And so what if there is no personality to offend? Like that feels like too good to be true because it's so deep in me. Yes, it is. It is freeing. And so I've been leaning into that idea. And as I've been, you know, making choices about who I spend time with or just what I choose to do, I'm thinking more in terms of, is this helpful for me? Is this nurturing and nourishing for me? If I make a choice that I feel some sense of like, that didn't get the results that I wanted, then I get to make a different choice. It's not like I've offended some deity on high, you know, or damaged my connection or whatever. So there's a deeper sense of peace and flow to how I'm choosing to spend my time and how I'm choosing to live.
Yeah, I want to speak to that because I think that's actually really important. I think for a lot of us in our deconstruction, in our evolution away from evangelicalism, I have found personally, and it sounds like you have as well, but in my walk, it's been necessary for me to let go of that that supreme being, personality on high, the judge of men's souls, right? And instead embrace this idea of God that was found, honestly, in the medieval mystics, like Meister Eckhart, St. John of the Cross, Anselm, perhaps. God is the ground of being, as Tom, you mentioned, that God is this presence that is found in the immanent, found in the material here and now, that there isn't this kind of two-world split. I don't know what I mean by that entirely, and I like that. I'm learning to embrace the ineffable qualities of it, but it's been a necessary part of my journey, and it sounds like yours as well, to kind of lose my belief in that classic old man in the sky with the stick that's going to hit you if you sleep with somebody outside of marriage, or if you take his name in vain, That God, for a lot of us, needed to die in order so that we might truly live into the life of Christ, into this kind of radical love and compassion, finding God in the midst of our lives as they actually are, and embracing the doubt and the unknowing, making peace with that. For a lot of us, that personality has had to die, and that's been a liberating thing, but it's also been a painful, painful thing, a scary thing. Thank you for sharing that, yeah. Well, anybody else? Yeah, Tom. Yeah, please. Go ahead. No problem.
In terms of experiencing the mystical, and I like using the term magical too, just because it's a word that interests me a lot, because my wife and I come from a Pentecostal tradition, and where it is very magical, but magical in the sense of like the belief that you can have control over nature, control over the things that happen to you. And we took my wife's father in a few months ago. He had stage 4 cancer, and he spent the rest of his life with us. And the contrast that I sort of saw in our experience of the mystical and the magical in the ways that he encountered his suffering, and then we sort of encountered the suffering of losing him. And because he was like Pentecostal with a capital Entecostal, like he was... It was heartbreaking to see him in the mornings or in the evenings praying and realizing that there's this fear that he has of dying, that if he doesn't say the prayers the right way, or maybe if he doesn't pray enough, or if he doesn't speak in tongues enough, or if he doesn't read the right scriptures, that this idea that there is a right way to do this to cure his cancer and to cure his disease. And so hard for him to admit that he had a disease, or admit that he, and even to the very end, not able to admit what was happening to himself. And it was heartbreaking for us to watch him sort of experience life in that sort of bad magical sense, but it sort of birthed in us our ability to deal with his passing in our own way, that we began to understand sort of the mystical in the sense of just life, just experiencing life and just experiencing the feelings as they come and the emotions as they come, and the release of experiencing the grief. When the grief hits you, you just let it hit you, and then you experience just the presence of God and the transcendent experience of losing someone, but also feeling very connected with them still. And we got to understand, sort of by contrast and by separating ourselves from that, just sort of the mystical wonder and awe of being and life and death in a really new way.
Sounds like you've made peace with a lot of the questions that haunted him, but you've worked through it, and so many of you have. Well, let's end with that. What do you say? The Super Bowl starts in 4 hours, and so we need to start praying for the Rams now, and I mean now. God bless Tom Brady, but never mind. All right. God has blessed Tom Brady. Yeah. I saw, by the way, real quick, I saw a meme this week. Basically, it's an old picture of Jesus like holding a lamb, but he's got like the football marks. And if you look closely, somebody actually made it into Tom Brady, but it looks just like Jesus anyway. I don't know why we're ending with that, but it's kind of a mystical understanding of Jesus. Good enough. Well, next week we're going to talk about Judaism and understand the roots of that. And obviously a lot of correlation there for us Christians. So that's going to be interesting to squeeze into 20, 25 minutes. But thank you so much for being here. Be safe out there on the roads. Go in peace.